key thing is, don't be inhaling, don't be ingesting.
Stay inside, don't drink or eat anything.
These are important questions.
I understand that. Highest moment the last 8 years.
Highest moment the last 8 years. Well, I think the most important, the most compelling was 9/11 itself.
Welcome. This is the special live edition of Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, back after a rather long, well, not entirely an absence, but I guess I have been on a pretty reduced schedule now since mid-September, but I'm back and ready to pretty much pick up where I left off after a wild and crazy trip to Morocco, Spain, France, and where else? Well, I guess that was pretty much it. I would like to talk about the trip tonight, but I don't have a whole lot of time to do that because we have two great guests already signed up to come on. Actually, three great guests. First hour, John Milkovich, Louisiana State Senator, who actually gave the eulogy at the funeral of murdered 9/11 witness Dr. David Graham. John Milkovich is one of those rare politicians who actually cares about the truth and justice and stands for the values that he believes in. He's a family values guy who actually believes that stuff, not like certain Republicans we know. Pretty much all the rest of them, well, not quite, but you know what I'm saying. Republican Party is basically a big scam to get working class people to vote against their own interests. How do they do that? They monopolize the traditional values rhetoric. Over on the Democratic side, we're all metrosexuals now, and the silent majority doesn't buy it, so they vote for Republicans who pick their pockets because the Republicans hypocritically talk the family values talk while raping and pillaging and committing all sorts of indecencies that I would never want to talk about on a family radio show, at least not very often. Anyway, let's see if we can get a hold of John here. Well, first of all, let me mention the second hour. Great topic there, too. Gordon Duff and Ian Greenhall, the editors over at Veterans Today, are going to come on and talk about this really hot new article. Actually got mentioned on CNN that Trump and Trump's son-in-law and consigliere, Jared Kushner, are responsible for ordering the Khashoggi murder. That's right. It's highly unlikely that the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia would ever dare to do something like that without some kind of American green light. They don't do anything without some kind of American green light. And in this case, the green light would have come from Trump and Kushner, who are very, very tight with the royal family, super, super tight with bin Salman, the young, reckless, allegedly designer amphetamine-addicted leader of Saudi Arabia. And so Khashoggi, who was chased out of Saudi Arabia for criticizing Trump and works for the Washington Post, Trump's nemesis, may be the first victim of Trump's attitude that journalists are the enemy of the people. In other words, if you criticize Trump, you might get slowly cut up to death with a bone saw. That's the way mafia people send messages, and Trump and his Cosa Nostra princeling friend, Jared Kushner, are nothing if not mafia. So we'll get into that in the second hour. Let's see if we can find our first hour guest, John Milkovich. I don't see him on Skype right now, but we're going to see what happens if we try to add him. Maybe he'll answer. Maybe he won't. If he answers, we'll have our conversation. And if he doesn't, we'll figure something else out. I know Dr. Rowe has been doing a fantastic job.
John Milkovich. Down.
Hey, there's John. Hi, Senator Milkovich. How you doing? Kevin Barrett here. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Dr. Barrett. How are you?
I'm hanging in there, considering I had a near-death experience in Morocco 1 week from tomorrow.
Oh, but, my goodness.
Yeah. I'm almost 60. You should probably get a body. Go ahead.
I was going to say, we would prefer for you to survive. You have important work to do.
Well, you know, people are either telling me that or they're telling me, well, man, if you're going to get killed in some crazy way, at least get martyred.
How about we opt for staying alive?
There you go. That's my preference, frankly. Yeah, well, as you know, people do occasionally get martyred for this kind of stuff. In my case, though, that wave that drove me headfirst into the sand at a ridiculous amount of speed and with incredible force was actually just an act of God. I can't blame anybody for it. So except myself, my own stupid self, for being dumb enough to go ahead and catch that wave. So I've heard all sorts of great stuff about you, and everything I see about you, it looks pretty darn good. We don't have that many actual honest politicians out there. Whatever led you to take up such an unusual career choice?
Well, you're very kind to say that, Dr. Barrett, and I guess we just idealistic and want to make a difference, and we tell people all the time, I haven't made a difference by myself, but really, God and the people of our, we have a wonderful, wonderful traditional values district that I represent in Northwest Louisiana, and we know that we've made a difference working together.
It's interesting, isn't it, that it seems that if you're going to get elected and tell the truth about things that some of the powers that be don't want you to tell the truth about, it almost helps to be from someplace as far away from Washington, D.C., New York, and maybe Hollywood, culturally, as you could possibly get.
You know, that's a very astute observation. I never thought about it quite like that. I guess that's one of the reasons why it's really benefits me to talk to smart people, because it seems like you're one of these people I'm going to get done talking to you, and I'm going to feel smarter than I was before I started the interview with you.
Well, I hope so. I was thinking that you mentioned that district that you're coming from, and another uncommonly honest politician from the South, my good friend Dr. Cynthia McKinney, also came from, the reason that she could keep getting elected to Congress, and she was elected 6 times to the U.S. Congress, even though she was doing things like refusing to sign the pledge to be loyal to Israel rather than the United States. Everybody else in Congress pretty much signs that. She refused to. And then she also, she grilled Donald Rumsfeld on the floor of the House about his complicity in 9/11, how Rumsfeld had set up drills. You know, there were 46 drills involved with 9/11, of which about half of those, more than 25, were actually running on 9/11 itself, sending all of our air defenses up to the North Pole in an imaginary Russian attack, having a plane into building exercise that apparently went live, evacuating the National Reconnaissance Office, where an imaginary plane was heading to smash into it. And that meant that the people who would normally be looking at what our satellites see were not there to see what our satellites see. And had they been there, they would have seen our satellites showing that the allegedly hijacked planes that we were told slammed into those buildings were something very, very different than what we've been told. Anyway, so Cynthia grilled Rumsfeld about that on the floor of the House of Representatives, and she lived to tell the tale. And I think part of the reason that she could get elected 6 times to Congress in the face of really serious opposition from the most powerful people on the planet is that her district in Atlanta was an overwhelmingly African-American district that is made up of people who are too smart to believe the BS coming out of Washington, D.C. And it sounds like your district is like that, too.
Well, you know, and I certainly would have a different perspective from Congresswoman McKinney on our allegiance to Israel. I feel like they're a valuable, historically valid and vital ally.
Well, you know, I hope you come out of the show smarter than that.
but you know what? I really, really admire her for taking on Secretary Rumsfeld. And I wasn't aware of that particular line of questioning. I was aware of some of those issues, but not to the degree that you stated. And listen, that very line of questioning and that type of inquiry illustrates why it's absolutely necessary to freedom, self-government, and self-determination to have 3 branches of government, including a legislative branch that's not owned by the executive branch and not limited by the judicial function, but is really there to advocate for the people. So I applaud Congresswoman McKinney for asking those hard questions of the Secretary of Defense.
Well, just to clarify, you're not saying that you really support people elected to Congress signing a pledge of loyalty to a foreign nation?
Well, you know, I guess I haven't seen the paperwork on that. But, you know, I do support Israel. Now, I understand that there is in Israel, as in other nations, that there can be controlling factions which take actions which are inimical to the innate purpose of a nation. I certainly understand that. But do I honor our historical allegiance to Israel, qua Israel? Yes, I do.
Well, I'll be happy to send you a reading list that I think, if you actually read, you know, the 3, 4, or 5 books that I list, will radically change your perspective. But we'll moving from there back to the issue of
And I think it's important too to when I say Israel, some might say, "Well, are you approving everything that the Mossad or people acting under the, you know, the color of another nation's flag have done?" No, because I feel that the governmental and sometimes intelligence functions of many nations violate international law, violate ethical rules, violate moral standards. So I do understand that dimension of it. The corrupt elements in, the present in government, not just you know across the globe. I appreciate if that's your concern. I certainly understand that.
Well, that's probably a lot of it in that today, of course, this Likud government in Israel, which was the main force that organized the 9/11 attack on America, as well as the series of false flag events attributed to radical Muslims ever since, London, Madrid, Bali, Charlie Hebdo, the other Friday the 13th attack in France, all of those are largely orchestrated by Israel's Mossad, which was the red team or Team B on 9/11. There was essentially...
Well, let me, and I am not an expert on that, and I certainly would not represent myself to be an expert on that. What I can tell you is I can certainly and unequivocally, you know, without knowing who is behind the attacks that you mentioned, I'm against false flag operations. I'm against operations that kill innocent human beings in order to achieve political leverage or economic gain. That's, you know, I'm a Christian. As a Christian, that's anathema to my basic values. And when those things occur, and I know that they do, again, I'm not an expert on the specific issues that you addressed, they need to be exposed. And I think that's why the work that you do is very important, Dr. Barrett, and it's important for you to we want to pray for your health, and even if that means let's stick with some more moderate waves in your surfing adventures, that I think we need to consider that. Yeah. I don't know if I can pass anything in Louisiana legislature that would keep you off the more dangerous waves, but
well, yeah, I appreciate you.
We could pass. You know, pass a resolution. But it would not be strictly binding. It would not have force of law. It would have suggestive impact is all.
Okay. Well, as long as I don't have to, you know, sign a pledge of loyalty to a foreign nation's waves, I'll be happy. Well, how about the issue of false flags is something that you actually had a brush with. Dr. David Graham appears to have had some encounters with the alleged 9/11 hijackers before 9/11, which made him very suspicious, and it appears that he very likely was murdered due to the trouble that could have resulted had he continued to talk about that. And, you know, I've done a fair bit of study on these alleged 9/11 hijackers, and my goodness, the amount of information that's out there, even in the mainstream media, is astounding. Showing that, you know, there's a really something rotten in Denmark here. Maybe you could introduce some of our listeners who may not have heard about this to Dr. Graham and his story.
Sure, Dr. Barrett, thank you so much. David Graham was a personal friend of mine. David was a Vietnam veteran who served. He was a dental surgeon before he went to Vietnam, and he therefore had the opportunity to make MedCap missions into the South Vietnamese countryside, which during the Vietnamese War, I did not serve in Vietnam. The war in Vietnam ended my senior year of high school. But as veterans certainly know, and we know from studying the reports of the veterans, the South Vietnamese countryside was infiltrated heavily with Viet Cong. David Graham was a Keithville, Louisiana country boy, went to dental school, and signed up to go to Vietnam, defend his country's principles, and he volunteered for 62 MedCap missions into the Vietnamese countryside to provide dental, primarily dental care to Vietnamese villagers. Took his life in his own hands. Basically, every time he went on one of those trips, they never knew when there was going to be communist encounter with communist guerrillas. And he did that. He volunteered for every single one of the missions that were presented to his command because he said other men had families. So David Graham was, and he was decorated for his bravery in Vietnam. And he came home, back home to Louisiana, ran a dental practice. In Dr. Barrett, in the fall of 2000, he, perchance, by doing some medical research on his own, some physiology, encountered a Dr. Mohammed Ahmed, who linked him to, introduced him to a fellow, a character named Jamal Khan, who introduced him to two historically significant players, two of the 9/11 hijackers, and that Dr. Graham noted that they were doing some highly suspicious things. They were pretending that they were medical doctors. They were not. They were struggling with English language. They were wanting to get onto Marshall Air Force Base in Bossier City, Louisiana, which is one of the largest military nuclear installations in the Western Hemisphere, talking about getting on base with a van. Dr. Graham perceived and feared that they were trying to commit a terrorist attack on the Barksdale Air Force Base in Bossier City, Louisiana. He reports them to the FBI and to the Federal Secret Service. And that was in about November of 2000. No action. He reported them. He gave very detailed reports to federal agents. And then in October of 2001, while he was sitting down to eat at a diner in Shreveport, Louisiana, he was stunned as he picked up a copy of the USA Today newspaper that had pictures of the 19 hijackers. Two of them had been in Shreveport, Louisiana, and David Graham had met them. They were the suspicious actors who were pretending to be doctors. By the way, one of their cohorts was talking about meeting personally with Osama bin Laden. David Graham had reported them duly, clearly, in detail to federal agents. Federal agents had done nothing. And by the way, their names for the viewers that have really done their research on the 9/11 were Nawaf al-Hazmi and Fayez Bani Hamid. David Graham reported them, told the feds about them. When he found out that the two people he reported were involved in the 9/11 attacks, he went ballistic. He contacted the local FBI office and basically demanded, "What were you all thinking about? Why do you think I came to you? Why do you think I complained? Why do you think me, as a Vietnam veteran who's been in battle and been battle tested and understands intelligence and military matters, why do you think I went to you with this complaint for you to do nothing about it?" And David understood, Dr. Barrett, that if federal agents and the federal agencies had done their job and interrogated, investigated these people, they could have pulled the plug on 9/11 in November of 2000.
Well, I don't know if that would have totally pulled the plug, although very possibly, you know, I don't know if you're aware of some of the other material on these alleged hijackers that's even, you know, equally or more outrageous than this. Have you seen Daniel Hopsicker's book, Welcome to Terrorland?
I have not. Now, I know that Sander, I believe, questioned him, but no, the short answer is no, I have not read that.
It's pretty interesting. You know, just to give you a couple of examples.
Sure.
You know, this outrageous behavior by these guys pretending to be MDs getting into Barksdale Air Force Base. That's pretty extreme behavior. Now remember, let's stop and think about this. Okay. According to the official version of events, these 19 guys were sent over, 15 from Saudi Arabia and 4 from other countries in the Middle East. A lot of them didn't speak English. And rather than training, flight training in their home countries, where there's plenty of flight training available in their native languages, we're told that they were sent over here like a year and a half ahead of time on special CIA snitch visas, but that's not, they don't mention that in the 9/11 Commission report. So we're told they were sent over here, and they would learn to fly supposedly in a language that they don't even speak a year and a half ahead of time. And then they would do all these completely insane things like you just described a few, you know, impersonating doctors, going onto Barksdale Air Force Base under false pretenses. Now just think, if you were like a really high level terrorist operative who was planning to carry out the biggest attack in history, would you be sent over that soon to operate in a language that you can't even speak, doing insane things? Well, let's look at what some of these other guys did. Mohammed Atta, who was supposedly the ringleader, went to the Small Business Administration office in Florida, forget which city it was, and this is before 9/11, during this period when he was pretending to take flying lessons at a CIA drug import airstrip. And during that period, he went to the Small Business Administration and made a spectacle of himself by telling the person, I want this multi-million dollar loan. I'm not leaving this office till I get it in cash. I'm going to use this money to buy a crop duster airplane so I can drop chemical. And then he said, oh, look at that picture of that aerial photo of Washington, D.C. behind your desk. I must have that. Please take that, rip that off the wall right now and give it to me. By the way, did you know that Osama bin Laden is the world's greatest hero? So he's you know, acting like a complete madman in the Small Business Administration person's office. And this is the guy who's supposedly able to maintain such great cover that nobody even got a whiff of this so-called plan. It's completely ridiculous. That's just one example. These guys were they were all over many secure U.S. military facilities, regularly exercised in the officers' clubs in Pensacola Naval Air Station and other secure U.S. military facilities. As I said, they were participating in drug smuggling. They were regularly partying on Jack Abramoff's casino boats, flying to Las Vegas, dating prostitutes and strippers everywhere they went, drinking high-shelf whiskey, and they had unlimited supplies of cocaine. On the night before 9/11, this is all reported in mainstream media sources, one group of alleged hijackers left an alcohol-soaked Quran in a bar at 3 in the morning, the night before they supposedly did this really amazing deed. And this whole thing is completely insane. The guy at Mohammed Atta in Florida, by the way, did you know this? Spoke fluent Hebrew, according to his pink-haired stripper girlfriend, Amanda Keller. The original Mohammed Atta in Germany was a very, very shy, timid, quiet, pious Muslim. He was impersonated by a man who spoke fluent Hebrew and other languages that Atta didn't speak, and who had the exact opposite personality of Atta, extremely outgoing, boisterous, and psychopathic. So I could go on like this for a very long time, but the point being that what Dr. Graham saw was kind of the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, well, and listen, there's nothing but questions about this. Dr. Barrett, I appreciate you addressing this issue. Dr. Graham's chronology, and listen, I understand this is one part, one tentacle of the plan to conduct this horrible terror attack on American soil. Dr. Graham, in his conversations with the FBI, because they did not afterwards, he said, why did you do nothing? Why didn't you stop this? Why didn't you debrief these people? Why didn't you interrogate them? Why did you do nothing? Because he was getting nowhere with the local federal officials, basically put his findings, research experience, observations, what he saw firsthand in writing, to try to send it up the flagpole within the federal intelligence bureaucracy so he could get someone. And basically his point was, look, you all did not just fumble the ball. You dropped the ball on human lives in New York City. He was expecting answers. And when they didn't respond, you know, with alacrity, he reduced his findings to writing. And he told the FBI he was doing that. When they did not act, he formulated and drafted the David Graham, the 9/11 David Graham report, or 9/11 Graham report, and actually hand-delivered it to the counsel for the congressional inquiry into 9/11. When the congressional 9/11 inquiry did not respond in a meaningful way, and listen, I don't know whether that report, the extent to which it ever got to the full committee, was entrusted to counsel. And then, you know, was that a roadblock? Was that a sieve? Was that a black hole? I don't know. But ultimately, David Graham said, look, he did not get a meaningful response from federal agents on the ground in Shreveport, Louisiana. He did not get a significant substantive response from the United States Congress or the committee. So he ultimately said, look, I'm taking my findings about the fact that these maniacs were in Shreveport, Louisiana, the fact that they were doing highly suspicious things, the fact that I reported them very clearly 10 months before 9/11, said, I'm putting my findings in writing, I'm turning into a book, and I'm taking this case to the American public.
And then what happened?
Well, on late May of 2004, it was the night of May 28th, David Graham was in Houston to visit a friend of his whose wife was dying of cancer in the hospital. And somehow, and I don't know exactly how it happened, Dr. Barrett, but David ended up with meeting with a friend of his friend who happened to be a member of the Coast Guard, and which was then part of the Department of Homeland Security. And they went out and had a few drinks at the upper deck, Lake Conroe, Texas. And apparently, from what we've been able to piece together, someone dropped antifreeze in the drinks, one or more drinks that he was drinking. For the listeners that aren't aware, antifreeze has got a sweet taste, so you can drink it in a sweet drink or a flavored drink and not notice it. It's highly toxic. It doesn't kick in right away. The next day, about 12 hours later, after drinking the drinks with his friend's friend, who was in the Homeland Coast Guard, Department of Homeland Security, basically had seizures driving back from Lake Conroe, Houston, Texas area to Shreveport. He basically cratered in Lufkin, Texas, about 12 hours after being at that bar. The medical text, the baseline is that antifreeze as a poison kicks in about 12 hours later because the body metabolizes the toxins or the metabolizes the chemicals present in the antifreeze, and the toxicity is felt about 12 hours later. So the toxic effects were felt about 12 hours after he was drinking in Lake Conroe, Texas, outside of Houston. So based upon that, we're able to fairly well with some level of some level of confidence, probabilistically, if not definitively, state that he got poisoned at that event at Lake Conroe drinking. And this was the interesting and really haunting thing about this, Dr. Barrett, is that shortly after he was poisoned, the FBI agents start showing up in the ER where he was being treated and he was fighting for his life. The FBI, number one, shows up. Number two tells the doctors that he's a crazy suicidal nut, that he tried to commit suicide, basically tried to dissuade the doctors from saving his life, the doctors in Lufkin and or Houston.
Wow.
The FBI sent a report back to Shreveport that he had died, which was false. The FBI released a report to the local FBI to the local media, suggesting that David Graham was suicidal. He was a personal friend of mine. Suicidal was the last thing that he was. The FBI later denied that they had met with him before 9/11. Of course, the intrepid Sander Hicks confronted one of them who broke down and said, well, yes, we did meet with them before 9/11. So and by the way, what I left out is David told them that he was going to publish his findings. An FBI agent threatened him. The FBI agents made it very clear they did not want him publishing his findings that the 9/11 terrorists were in Shreveport and reported 10 months before 9/11. So they threatened him. They were there after he got poisoned. They were tried to discourage the doctors from saving his life. They falsely told people in Shreveport that he was dead when he was not. They floated the story that he was suicidal, and they falsely denied that they had met him before 9/11. So in what was going on at the same time in 2004, when David was poisoned. And by the way, the rest of the story is he could have died, but the doctor saved his life. He was stricken, paralyzed. He never got out of a bed again the rest of his life, never walked out of a bed, never was able to walk under his own power. His voice box was partially paralyzed. He lived another 2.5 years. But David Graham was poisoned right in the middle of Robert Mueller's efforts to cover up, number one, America's foreknowledge, the advance warnings that 9/11 was going to happen. He lied and said we have no previous intelligence or warnings or red flags or alarm bells, which, Dr. Baer, you know that's false.
Yeah, remember Condoleezza Rice saying, we never even imagined. And it turns out that there were actually, there was more than one drill imagining planes being used as weapons that was actually happening on 9/11 itself.
And certain insiders were specifically warned. And somebody in the administration said later at a commencement speech that basically before 9/11, the day before 9/11, we knew everything we needed to know. And so someone in the administration admitted this at a graduation after 9/11, that by the day before 9/11, we knew everything we needed to know about the how, the when, where the attack would occur. I said all that to say that this is the book, Dr. Barrett, is Robert Mueller, Errand Boy for the New World Order. That's Robert Mueller, Errand Boy for the New World Order. And what the book documents, and this is not my say-so, my findings, my deductions or surmise, this is the documented fact, is Robert Mueller lied to Congress repeatedly and said that we had no advance warnings of 9/11. You know that's false. And he said, because this attack occurred, we need a mass surveillance state. We need a surveillance state. We need blanket surveillance of every law-abiding citizen in America, cradle to grave, dark to night, or, you know, dawn to dusk. We need electronic surveillance of telephonic communications, faxes, emails, texts, phone conversations. We need a surveillance state. And the lie was, number one, that America needed a mass surveillance state to prevent 9/11, which was based on another lie, which was we had no warnings and there's no way we could have prevented this. Well, the lie in all of that is there was multiple warnings that were sent from the rank and file federal agents, the federal agents in the trenches, the infantry of the federal agency and citizen whistleblowers were telling the establishment, the government, and the hierarchy over and over again, there's a terrorist attack coming. So Mueller lied and said there was no terrorist attack. He said he lied and said that we had no advance warnings. He said the only way we could have prevented this is with a surveillance state. And he told Congress, you need to give us our surveillance state.
Yeah, this is so, you know, it's un-American in so many different ways. You know, our country's founded on this ideal of liberty. That's really the basis of the American experiment. And the Bill of Rights is really the core of that. And they've shredded it. You know, I tell these guys at the airport that search me when I'm boarding planes, I always tell them, you know, you're committing treason. That's actually a capital offense. You know, there's this thing called the Fourth Amendment, and you're not allowed to search me unless you have a warrant signed by a judge explaining why you're searching me, why there's probable cause to think I'm doing something illegal, and precisely what you're searching for. And other than that, you can't touch me. You can't even look at me.
That's a brilliant point. What we talk about in our book, Dr. Barrett, is Mueller's track record of being an operative, you know, for an apologist, schemer for what some people call the deep state, some people call, you know, the rogue CIA, what some people call black ops. But he's got his anti-constitutional history goes back to the Whitey Bulger gang. That was the Irish mobsters that ruled Boston or committing murders during for about 19 years. They were killing people, and FBI agents were implicated not only in tipping them off, not only in taking bribes from them, not only in protecting them and helping them evade prosecution from honest cops. They were ultimately implicated in committing or covering up murders. That was printed in the Boston Globe.
Yeah, well, the FBI hit squad killing people for the mafia.
I mean, it's insane. The Whitey Bulger gang. And during that 19-year period, Robert Mueller was there in the middle of it geographically and temporally. He was in Boston, right in the temporal epicenter of the Whitey Bulger gang heyday, homicidal heyday, serving as assistant U.S. attorney and as U.S. attorney. So that's the Whitey Bulger gang. The Pan Am 103. The immediate intelligence after the bombing of Pan Am 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland, was, look, it's Ahmed Jibril, a terrorist, and working with the Syrians, paid by the Iranians. Well, all of the intelligence pointed that. The intelligence officers had intercepted the intelligence showing that Jibril was paid by Iran $1 million before the bombing, paid $10 million after the bombing, bragged about committing the bombing. Jibril's guys were caught in Germany about 4 to 6 weeks ahead of time with bombs just like the ones that blew up Pan Am 103. And then apparently there was some high-level discussions between the United States and England about, look, we're going to war in the Gulf. We need Iran and Syria. So the investigation did a 180, turned away from Syria, Jibril, and Iran, pointed at two Libyan intelligence officers that, based upon the evidence, had nothing to do with the crime. And Mueller was leading the investigation that ended up convicting a Libyan intelligence officer who had nothing to do with it. And by the way, it was documented that one of the key witnesses against the Libyan intelligence officer who did do the crime was given millions of American dollars and sent to Australia to live. Another one reports that when he was at the FBI headquarters in 91, by the way, the bombing happened in 88, it reports that when he was in the FBI headquarters in 91, he was offered a bribe of $4 million to implicate the Libyan intelligence officers. Well, so that was a political whitewash. Instead of going after the terrorists that did it, the Iranians in Syria, they did a political 180. Mueller was leading that false investigation. BCCI. Look, Paul Manafort.
Yeah, let me stop you there for a second, because
let's go.
I think you got that like at least 75-80% right. However, are you aware of the Israeli report? And here's a case where I'm actually kind of on the side of Israel in one of these examples, which is kind of weird.
You're talking about Interfor?
Yeah. They said that this was done by a gang of CIA drug dealers out of the Ka Valley, Lebanon, where the Iranian Hezbollah people have a presence there too. But basically, there was a team of CIA people.
Oh, no, listen.
They're flying back home on that flight to blow the whistle on CIA control of that drug trade. And they were taken out in an op that was designed to be blamed on Iran.
Listen, that is exactly what the intelligence shows, what you just said. And I guess I thought that might be a little bit too
we don't want to blame Iran for something that they didn't do.
Iran paid for it, according to the intelligence.
Yeah,
Jibril wasn't separated, divorced from the CIA. He was connected to them by Al-Qassar, who was the Middle East heroin trafficker, who was working with the CIA. And you're exactly right. Charles McKee got blown to bits in that bombing, and he was a honorable United States Army veteran who was a major, highly decorated, who was in the Mideast to rescue the Western hostages from Lebanon. And you're right, he did come across a CIA-protected drug ring that was trafficking heroin from the Mideast to American cities. You're absolutely right. And that's the rest of the story, is that there was CIA connections between the terrorists that did the bombing, and, yes, the CIA was connected to them, and when Pan Am 103 was blown out of the sky above Scotland, it was carrying, you're correct, Charles McKee and several federal agents that were going to America to blow the whistle on the CIA-protected drug ring. That's exactly right. So that's not two different stories. It's Jibril was connected to Al-Qassar, and Al-Qassar was running the drug ring, which the CIA was involved in.
They were all kind of working together, and I'm sure there could have been some degree of Iranian involvement at some level.
Thank you, Robert Mueller, for doing nothing for the Whitey Bulger reign of terror in Boston. Thank you for covering up Pan Am 103. BCCI, that's reports say that $10 to $15 billion were scammed. The bank was financing covert black ops, international terrorism, international drug trafficking, and Bush Sr. brought Mueller in. And what does Mueller do? He gives a slap on the wrist on some international heavies that are involved in serious wrongdoing and dealing with money 1,000 times more than Paul Manafort is accused and convicted of ripping off the federal government, the stakes were monetarily 1,000 times higher. And, of course, he went after Manafort, and I think he got, you know, sentences which potentially would continue for the rest of Paul Manafort's life. But the BCCI players, who were the real big boys, got a slap on the wrist. Ruby Ridge, Randy Weaver's wife, shot to death while she's holding her 10-month-old baby in the doorway of their house. His 14-year-old son got shot to death with a submachine gun as he was running back to his cabin. Randy Weaver got shot in the back as he was looking at his son's body the next day while he was unarmed by a federal sniper that tried to shoot him in the spine, sever his spine, and kill him. So dad gets shot in the back, unarmed. The mom gets shot while she's holding her baby. And the 14-year-old, he did have a gun. Apparently, there's different stories. The Fed said that Weaver's son and his buddy started it. They say that the feds came out of the brush and started firing on them. But basically, two family members killed, Randy Weaver wounded, and the agents that were, or persons that were close to Mueller or that had access to him, said after the fact he was furious. Not that federal agents, 300 federal agents, had surrounded Weaver and his family, and they shot his wife Vicky to death. They named their camp Camp Vicky, and every morning went out and hollered, "Vicky, do you want some blueberry pancakes?" Well, Mueller wasn't upset about the fact that armed federal agents shot Randy Weaver while he was unarmed, shot his 14-year-old son in the back as he was running to his cabin, and shot his wife unarmed. Mueller was furious that anyone had the audacity to criticize federal agents.
You're not allowed to criticize federal agents, even if they're the world's most insane psychopaths, apparently.
Well, and there's great, and you know, that's something that our book talks about. We're not criticizing all federal agents. We're saying this: federal agents are the ones that came forward and helped us write this book. They're the ones that said, we told them, we reported, we gave them the information, we blew the whistle, we got fired, we got our security clearance pulled. Basically, and you know, the Charles McKees of the world, of course, he died. Others were fortunate enough to survive. The David Grahams, the decorated Vietnam War veterans, the journalists that risked their lives or wrote the stories. There's many American heroes in this narrative. So we're not condemning all of the media. We're applauding those that did their job. We're not condemning all federal agents. We're honoring those that told the truth, even at the peril to their own careers and worse. We're honoring the soldiers and citizens that blew the whistle. But what we're saying is Mueller disregarded all of that, ignored all the warnings, lied, and told the American public and Congress, look, we had no idea this was going to happen. Well, I'm sorry, Robert Mueller. The mainstream media itself, in addition to independent researchers, have logged warning after warning after warning after warning. And he lied and said he had no warning, so he'd go to Congress and said, look, we need a surveillance state. What about the anthrax? Another Robert Mueller cover-up. The yep. FBI agent, am I going too fast?
No, you're absolutely right. I'm glad you're bringing up the anthrax case. That's a really important part of the whole 9/11 story. It's really one operation, 9/11 anthrax.
Well, and yeah, the pent bomb investigation. But Richard Lambert was the FBI agent that was nominally put in charge of the anthrax investigation. He ended up filing a whistleblower suit against the FBI for trying to sabotage the investigation. And basically what the FBI did is they singled out Ivins. Apparently he had a therapist who was kind of a psycho, a former drug addict who needed money and or help in legal proceedings and was, you know, morally not the strongest person, who was willing to betray her own patient, betray patient confidence, and basically publicly defame him and say that, you know, he needed some therapy. He was going through some issues. His mother had tried to abort him before he was born. But basically she trashed him publicly, and the FBI glommed on to her as a basis to publicly ridicule him. The problem is the chemical evidence said that the anthrax samples that he was working at his lab were manifestly, profoundly galaxies apart in the, with the, from the chemical composition of the anthrax used in the anthrax mailings. Number two, Richard Spurzel, a UN bioexpert, said, look, there's only four or five people in America that even know how to make this type of highly weaponized anthrax compound. He ain't one of them. Spurzel went on to say the FBI accused Ivins of doing this by himself in a couple days. He said, look, it would take me a year or more with the top staff, a full lab, all the resources I needed to try to come up with this type of weaponized anthrax. This guy didn't do it. Well, but they, and this is, and I got a little bit ahead of myself, the chronology on this, Dr. Barrett, was number one, they tried to lay it off on Iraq so they could potentially help get more
information. Well, yeah. The original story actually was Osama plus Iraq, because the original idea of 9/11 was to try to blame Osama plus Iraq, and they were going to drag Iraq into it with anthrax. And of course, anthrax was all tied in on 9/11 itself. The White House was put on Cipro by Jerome Hauer, who's one of the 9/11 anthrax operation organizers. And we had FBI people in the streets thinking that those planes that crashed into the towers, or so we're told, were full of anthrax. And then we had actually the alleged 9/11 hijackers, some of them in Florida, actually were sheep-dipped in anthrax by intelligence people of some kind. That is, there was an incident set up in which I think it was two or three of the people who were later going to be named as alleged 9/11 hijackers sought treatment for exposure to anthrax. That situation was created before 9/11 so that the neoconservatives who orchestrated the 9/11 event could later say that these same guys working for Saddam plus Osama had done both 9/11 and anthrax. But because of the heroism and integrity of some people in the FBI, that wasn't possible. The FBI would not go along with this BS claiming that this was a type of anthrax that could conceivably have come from any place other than those three or four people in U.S. secure germ warfare facilities who produce it.
Yes. Now, I don't know all of the information you just passed on, but that you just discussed.
Graham McQueen's book is a great, so if you, it's very, pretty short. If you haven't read Graham McQueen's book.
We cited it. I did not, break down the whole book, but we did cite his. You know, you're right, is that initially they were trying to put it, say that Iraq was guilty of the anthrax, and I have no doubt that what you say is true, that many in the FBI said, no, that's not what happened. Also, members of the scientific community say, look, this is not a do-it-yourself Play-Doh experiment, Lego logs that someone does in a cave. This is high-tech, some of the most sophisticated, biophysiological molecular science in the world. The Iraqis do not have the know-how or the technology or the apparatus to do this. This had to happen in an American lab that's being used by the military and or one of the federal intelligence agencies. So once Mueller couldn't get away with the Iraq story, the arrow or the blame potentially focused on an American lab working with the defense system. With the government and or the military, the federal intelligence agencies.
Let's stop for a moment and consider the implications. On those anthrax letters, somebody had scrawled, death to America, death to Israel, Allah is great. So whoever
that
did the anthrax.
Not exactly Bruce Ivins, philosophical leanings, by the way,
that's so ridiculous. I mean, that's I think it was Graham McQueen who said that, compared this to like the fake, Indian speak. If they were trying to blame Indians for this, they would have said, white men expect, big heap bad medicine or something. I mean, of course, it's ridiculous. It's a really bad attempt to do this anti-Muslim propaganda, which of course is what 9/11 and anthrax was really all about. Who wanted us to go attack Muslims? Obviously the Zionists in Israel, right?
That's a part of the story with which I am not conversant. The focus, the research that I've done was on Mueller's series of cover-ups. And what I can say, consistent with what you're saying, is that yes, they first tried to blame it on the Iraqis, and people in the scientific community, and you're saying the FBI said, no, they don't have the capability to do that. That the blame then is directed at a potential black op operation in an American lab. That looks horrible. So they had to single out a lone nut anthrax bad guy, and that ended up being Bruce Ivins. He didn't have the knowledge. He didn't have the anthrax. He did not have the same type of anthrax. He didn't have the resources. He didn't have the staff. He didn't have the team. And by the way, his handwriting did not match the handwriting that was used and sent with the anthrax mailings. But he had a therapist who was willing to publicly say that he was crazy and dangerous and unpredictable, so they were going to try to crucify him in the media before anyone looked at the evidence. And the very tragic demise of this story is that he either committed suicide and or something worse happened to him, or, well, I'm not sure what could happen worse, but he died either as a result of suicide from an overdose or foul play, just as it got to the point where the FBI was going to have to come forth with formal charges. And his death very conveniently spared Mueller's inquiry from public scrutiny, and it would have potentially fallen apart. By the way, Robert Mueller is one of the ones that went to Congress and said that Hussein had weapons of mass destruction to help us get all ginned up to go to war in Iraq. So what the information we have is that Saudis were involved, and so but instead of going to war in Saudi Arabia, we went to war in Iraq. The surveillance state, we've already talked about it. And really, this is the point of Robert Mueller, errand boy for the New World Order. And
you've got him placed right at the center of so many of these things. It's pretty amazing. I think you're absolutely right. He's obviously a key operative of the people pulling this stuff off.
Well, Dr. Barrett, what we believe the bottom line is that Robert Mueller has been portrayed by the many in the media, not all, as a I think as I said in the book that he was a portrayed by the mainstream media and among the politically correct as a quote on time button down press white shirt by the book Eagle Scout straight arrow unquote, and I could have added Dudley Do Right, and it's untrue. The real truth is that he's got a 30-year track record of treachery, deceit, cover-ups, and corruption, and he's left his imprint one way or another on his failure to lift a finger to stop the Whitey Bulger gang and their federal assistance. You know, their assistance from federal agents didn't. He was instrumental in the cover-up of Pan Am 103, which was not a Libyan intelligence officer, but was a full scope. And CIA connected criminal act. He gave a slap on the wrist to the principals in BCCI. He griped about the fact that federal agents were being taken to task for murdering two people and injuring a third at Ruby Ridge. He told the American people and the FBI or the Congress an untruth about 9/11, so they had no warning, so that he could get away with his argument for mass surveillance. He steered the anthrax investigation away from the people that were really involved towards a scapegoat who, died at a time that was very convenient for people who were going to try to put a bogus case that was falling apart against him. He went to Congress and said that Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, which basically supporting the case for war in Iraq, which has been a very expensive war. I believe over 4,500 American soldiers have been killed. Dan Frumkin from, and I think there's been, 132,000 documented injuries. Daniel Frumkin of Huffington Post says actually hundreds of thousands or perhaps 500,000 American soldiers have been wounded in Iraq, if you take into account the post-traumatic stress disorder, traumatic brain injuries, hearing loss, disease. And then, the tremendous amount of casualties among the Iraqi civilian population. There's just... we're making the point that this person has been at the core of multiple cover-ups, multiple instances of corruption in the last 30 years of American history, cover-up after cover-up after cover-up. He's right at the epicenter.
And here he is at the epicenter of this this crossfire between different organized crime factions, which is what it looks like to me, involving the surprise presidency of Donald Trump. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, my, I stayed in the book, and this is my personal conviction based upon my review of the research and just my observation. And listen, I don't know if this doesn't necessarily make me an expert. I think Americans are drawing their own conclusions. But I state and I believe that Robert Mueller is got a very decided agenda, a very set and concrete agenda to take out President Trump. That's what I believe. You know, it's just interesting to me that, and they're using classic Department of Justice tactics. I will say this. You know, there are some high-ranking people that have taken some heat from Department, that have really felt some heat from Department of Justice tactics. And, of course, I don't, you know, I don't wish that on anyone. I think that's, you know, that's terrorizing to have the Justice Department and, boy, you're going to roll the dice about whether you're going to get a fair trial in front of a federal court. Depends on what federal judge you end up with. And in some, you may get a fair trial, and others, you may not.
Yeah, I wouldn't put my faith in the American federal courts these days. We're living in a very interesting period, and I thank you so much, Senator John Milkovich, for standing up for truth and justice and calling it the way you see it. Remind us again where people can find your book on Robert Mueller, errand boy for the New World Order.
Thank you. The book can be ordered, Dr. Barrett, at our website, which is www.robertmuellerarronboy.com. That's
okay. We will link that at the radio schedule by way of truthgene.com. All right. Thank you, John Milkovich. Keep up the great work. Looking forward to another conversation.
Hey, Dr. Barrett, listen, I know you're getting off. You've really done a lot of homework. It's very evident to me that you have spent hundreds, if not thousands, of hours studying the background of these pivotal events. So I can tell you your homework is really...
I appreciate that, and you too. I very much look forward to reading your book and maybe doing
to your host.
Welcome back. This is the second hour of the live version of Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, waging the all-out struggle for truth and bringing on interesting folks with a lot of uncommonly courageous things to say, going where few mainstream voices dare to follow. Well, that was a pretty interesting interview with Senator John Milkovich. I wish I had a representative like that I could vote for. Maybe I'll have to run again myself so other people will have one. Maybe somebody will show up and step up here in southwestern Wisconsin. But honestly, I don't think any of our representatives around here are even close to that level of courage. All right, let's move on here to Gordon Duff and Ian Greenhall. They're the editors over at Veterans Today, where I also write. I'm technically an editor as well. Gordon's pretty much the boss, and Ian is these days one of the most active writers and publishers at VT. And they've been a step ahead of the crowd in several areas, including the story about this possible Trump administration complicity in the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi journalist who was working for the Washington Post when he went into the Saudi consulate in Turkey and never came out. It appears that he was brutally murdered at the orders of Crown Prince bin Salman of Saudi Arabia. The question becomes, does it end there? Would bin Salman have ordered this horrific torture murder of a Washington Post reporter if he didn't think that he had some protection in the U.S.? And isn't bin Salman a very close supporter, a very, very, very tightly knit kind of backer of the kosher Nostra princeling, Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law? In fact, we're told that bin Salman may have bailed Kushner out on the world's worst real estate investment, which was 666, was it Park Avenue, I think, in New York. So let's get into this story about the possible complicity of the Trump administration in this brutal murder of Khashoggi. This could bring down either the Crown Prince, maybe even the White House. They both appear to have been possibly complicit in it. Well, the Crown Prince, we know he was complicit in it. And Gordon and Ian may be right that it goes deeper than that. So first, let's try and pull up. Who should we pull up first, Gordon or Ian? There we go. We got him. Okay, there's Gordon. So let's add Gordon to the call. And I haven't had Gordon on for a while. Of course, I haven't had anybody on for a while. I was off doing crazy and stupid things in Morocco. But now I'm back so I can do smart and crazy things on the radio on a regular basis. And one of the smart, crazy, regular things I do on the radio is bringing on Gordon Duff. Hey, welcome, Gordon. How you doing?
Well, it's good to be on, Kevin, and it's good to see that you're currently, thus far, not dead.
Yeah. I almost managed to whack myself. I mean, I don't even need the Mossad when I'm body surfing down there in that crazy beach by El Jadida. My goodness. And I caught the world's worst wave. What an experience.
Last time I remember doing that, which was a while ago, was 1969, about 20 miles south of Da Nang, doing 15, 18 footers, where you get that wonderful feeling that you're flying until you're not flying anymore, and then you're 50 feet up the beach, picking sand out of yourself and trying to figure how many bones are broken.
Yeah, well, in my case, it was, you know, how many, you know, how big was that hole in my skull, and how many spinal whatever problems I had, and I'm still going to have to get an MRI to get the details on that, but anyway, well, I'm walking and I'm talking, and here I am. Let's bring Ian on. Ian Greenhall, our colleague at Veterans Today, loves to stay up until completely insane hours in his home in the north of England. He should be there, though. He said he was going to try and stay up for the show. I think it's like 3 o'clock in the morning there, 2 or 3.
No, it's 7 minutes past 2.
Only a bit past 2. Hey, hello, Ian.
There.
Oh, greetings from the other side of the big pond.
Yeah, well, I don't know who's crazier, people who stay up till 2 or 3 in the morning to be on my radio show, or people who try to body surf off of El Jadida, Morocco. But anyway, we got a great show here to do because, once again, VT is ahead of the crowd, talking about things before the rest of the media does. CNN apparently echoed us just a little bit, I think today or maybe yesterday. But VT is asking the obvious question. Would Bin Salman have really thought that he could torture a Washington Post reporter, a really prominent one backed by very rich people, torture this guy to death in the Saudi consulate in full view of the world? Would he have even imagined that of doing something like that if he didn't think he had some kind of backing from the White House?
Well, my thought on it is that it's so bad in terms of, you know, the fallout that it's like he's been set up. You know, he'd do this, yeah. So, you know, and so that then they can immediately turn on him and use it against him.
Well, that's, you know, Ian, they have an older brother in the wings. And, you know, Press TV yesterday reported that Pompeo was there to demand that Bin Salman be taken out of the line to the throne.
Yeah. Well, but my understanding, tell me if I'm right or wrong, is that the House of Saud is massive. That, you know, there are so many brothers and uncles and cousins and things, and there isn't, like, unlike, you know, the British monarchy, there isn't a hard and fast line of succession. You know, the king appoints his successor, so he can, you know, he picks.
Well, you know, one of the strange things when you work around there, the Saudis in person, you know, especially if you're outside Saudi Arabia, but are a fairly genial and liberal lot, who often as not will pick up checks, you know, which, you know, American Scots certainly don't do that, but aren't that bad a group of people to be around when they're not busy torturing, dismembering, or beheading people? You know,
Yeah, I mean, they're not notorious for, you know, looking to spend money on parties and things, but, you know, there is this medieval leftover, you know, that this is a form of Islam that one would have hoped had died out, you know. And
well, wait a minute. You got to separate the royals from the Wahhabis. The royals descend from a bunch of bandits who made their living by ripping off people going on the pilgrimage and often murdering the pilgrims. They were a bunch of badass warlords who preyed on their fellow Muslims, and then they made an alliance with the Wahhabis, who are kind of a different group, who are a bunch of crazed heretics who think that everybody else is the heretic, so they have the right to murder everybody else. So the Ibn Saud bandit family says, we want some religious legitimacy for preying on our fellow Muslims, for robbing and killing them. And the Wahhabis say, sure, we'll give you that legitimacy, because we say that we are the only true Muslims and everybody else deserves to die. So go and kill and rob anybody you want. So that's basically this marriage of convenience between these two factions. But they're very different. The royals are a bunch of playboys, and the Wahhabis are a bunch of fanatics.
You know, what we're looking at right now is, Pakistan, to an extent, has propped up the Saudi monarchy. And it's when you look at things there, you know, the huge resentment inside Pakistan that Islam's holy places are held down by a pack of camel merchants. Yet we don't know exactly how many Pakistani troops are in Saudi Arabia. They claim 3,000. We think 20,000. But Pakistan's new leader, who, by the way, is another VT columnist, Imran Khan. I know for a fact from personal conversations, does not have a warm place in his heart for Saudi Arabia. He's kind of said this more than once, you know.
Mm-hmm. Many people do, Gordon. The only warmth that anybody ever feels for the Saudis is when they're handing you money, and then it goes away real quick.
Well, Khan doesn't have a lot of money, but he does have a couple hundred nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this point, and he has his own sort of extremism about him, but blackmailing.
He's just sincerely religious, isn't he? I didn't think he was ever that extremist.
My connection dropped.
You're okay. We can hear you, Ian.
By extremism, he's very much politically a mainstream VT guy. He fits right in here. You know, he is, and I can't speak for someone who's become a national leader and describe their feelings about the U.S. or Zionism or things like that, because it's, but you would certainly be heartened by his feelings and find them way off center for what you would have expected.
Mm-hmm. No, I like him, you know, ever since you clued me into him years ago. You know, Gordon, you had him picked as a future leader of Pakistan. I think it was like 10 years. I think it was like when I first met you back going on 2010 or something like that, or in that area. You were ahead of the curve.
Well, I just enjoy him. He's a fun guy. He's nice to hang out with, you know, run around the car and, you know, go out to eat and go look at stuff. He's good company. And as people go, he's a very warm, friendly, decent person. And the status quo in Pakistan, which has been, you know, corruption, American domination, continual terrorism at the hands of India's RAW, MI6, and the Mossad, operating against Baluchistan, operating against SWAT in the Northwest Provinces, operating inside Peshawar, the thousands of deaths it's caused in Pakistan, and the tens of billions of dollars the nation has lost. Of course, the things we're talking about, there isn't a chance that 5% of the people in the audience will have a remote idea what we're talking about, so I probably ought to shut up.
Well, I can tell you one thing about Pakistan and the Pakistani diaspora, which is largely based in Britain, and that there isn't, you know, any Pakistani community anywhere that hasn't got, isn't riddled with MI5 informants. There isn't a mosque in England that hasn't got, you know, an MI5 operative in it. The Pakistani community have been and continue to be the most surveilled and abused and, used as scapegoats to be, group of people in Britain. And
a lot of the so-called alternative media participates in scapegoating Pakistani Brits and other Muslims. People like our old friend Alex Jones and a lot of these folks who, we used to think were sort of honest 9/11 truthers, and they've either been drinking the Kool-Aid or they're on the payroll or something, and they're on the wrong side.
Hey, Kevin, when you go back that 10 years when I told you about Imran Khan, didn't I also tell you that all of those people were also working for MI5 and the Mossad 10 years ago? And haven't you found out I was right then?
Gordon, you've always been telling me that pretty much everybody except you and me is on the Mossad payroll, and you're not so sure about me. You're not even quite so sure about you. You've been right a few times on that. I'll admit that.
You
predicted the hideous degeneration of Alex Jones before it was evident to me. So, I mean, you get things right.
Well, I am a trained professional. I mean, there is something to this, but I think
you go a little too far in this sometimes. For instance, this latest thing, or actually, no, this is you, Ian, I think, or both you guys maybe were dissing my good friend, the Saker. And the Saker, whatever, you may think he's wrong about this and that, but he's an honest guy. He's not. Okay, whatever.
I'm just saying that, Kevin, you're a soft-headed, soft-hearted person. You're an academic by trade. You have no intelligence training other than what you've gotten from a decade at VT, which isn't nothing. But your personal proclivity and, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm not a journalist. I'm an intelligence professional. I have professional assets for running background on people. The Saker and Fort Roos have long been identified as controlled opposition. The Saker in particular
is the same thing, of course.
No, they're controlled by exactly the same people.
I can tell you.
Okay, I put on the record opposition to that, but whatever.
I know.
I can tell you what I've found from looking at a whole host, about maybe 10 or 12 sites, is that they're all owned by companies that turn out to be fronts for Western think tanks, like the Jamestown Institute.
Booz Allen Hamilton, PJ Media, which is the a front for the Heritage Foundation, which is the front for the Atlantic Council, which is the front for NATO intelligence.
But the Saker is not connected to any of those guys.
Yes, it is.
I'll give you an example of how it worked in Russia. Alex Navalny is the young, he's only in his 40s, I think, blogger who was picked from, an arsehole who just wrote a blog, completely obscure, to being, built up as, according to the Western media, a serious opponent to Putin. And, there were all over Russia, young people turning up and protesting on behalf of Navalny. Well, they were all went to mobs, they were all paid to do it. Navalny was employed by the National Endowment for Democracy, which is why he was thrown in prison, why Putin banned the National Endowment for Democracy, because the National Endowment for Democracy was behind the Arab Spring, behind the war in Syria, behind Maidan in Ukraine. It's basically, the CIA's regime change operation, but privatized.
And of course, a lot of these guys like Alex Jones try to say it's actually George Soros doing all of this, blaming Soros for everything that NED
does. And that's, of course, the dip on that is the single most powerful anti-Zionist in the world is George Soros. Soros is deeply involved in Israeli politics as an anti-Likudist, anti-Zionist, progressive liberal, as he is in this country. When he opposed the Bush administration, he opposed the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq. He put his money up. He put his reputation. He opposed the Patriot Acts in this country. All of those things that we're all with George Soros. The reason the George Soros name is brought up entirely because parallel operations. George Soros is because of his background, has very bad feelings about traditional communism. But traditional communism, if you have any idea of the background, and I'm on a call where everybody on the call does, knows that it's Bolshevik and Jewish in nature.
There's a book by David Irving that's brilliant about the Hungarian uprising. And I've got several very close Hungarian friends who've told me all about it as well. Basically, what happened was that after the end of World War II, Hungary became communist, obviously. But what the Russians did was they brought in their own Hungarians from who had been living in Russia since 1919, when they had been thrown out of Hungary at gunpoint by Admiral Horthy and the monarchists, because in 1919 they tried to have a Bolshevik takeover and they murdered tens of thousands of Hungarians in the process. But they were defeated and they fled to Russia. And in 1945, Stalin sent them back to become the new communist government of Hungary. And these were, you know, the most bloodthirsty Jewish Bolsheviks, you know, you can imagine. You know, people like of the same ilk as Beria and Yagoda. And from 1945 to 1956, this Jewish Bolshevik regime in Hungary was, you know, was as bad as anything that there'd ever been under the Bolsheviks in Russia. And by 1956, the Hungarian people said, we're sick of these Jews who are, you know, using secret police and all these awful things against us. And they had an uprising. They didn't want to overthrow communism. They just wanted shot of those that Jewish leadership. So they overthrew them, put in place Hungarian communists, and told Khrushchev, look, we are not going to join the West, we're not leaving the Warsaw Pact, we just don't want this Jewish leadership. And Khrushchev and the Russian military leadership panicked, didn't believe them, and sent the tanks in to make sure they didn't leave the Warsaw Pact.
And then in the process, of course, burned down what would have been a relationship that could have helped hold the Soviet bloc together some decades later when destabilization pressures from the West and economic inequities within the Soviet Union came to bear, you know, which was brought around basically by a currency collapse within Russia itself.
Well, it left a schism in the communist bloc. That it absolutely horrified Yugoslavia and pushed them further away from Russia, and it left long-lasting enmity between Hungary, Romania and Bulgaria, because Romania and Bulgaria both participated in, you know, the crushing of the 56 uprising.
And in the immediate aftermath, we saw formation of dissident organizations in Latvia and Estonia, and we began seeing the underpinnings of what later turned out to be Solidaridad, a resurgence of Christianity in Poland, and the building of what turned out to be a powerful social movement. All of that happened over a number of years, and all this while, mind you, the Radio Liberty, Radio Free Europe, USAID, you know, operations throughout the Baltics and Eastern Europe, you know, mostly headquartered out of Vienna, had been pounding away at the Soviet Union with ham-handed propaganda, plots of varying kinds, schemes of one kind or another but those schemes after 1956 began to bear a lot more fruit. And as Russia turned to increasingly idiotic leaders, and of course the end of the trail for Russia's credibility was Yuri Andropov, who said known psychopath. Mm. He may not have been long lived as a premier, but it was the writing on the wall.
I would point the finger at Andropov as being the cooker in the nest, being the chief Zionist Israeli agent within.
And that leads to the larger question of Jewish tribal or Zionist involvement in communism. And I guess, I don't know if you guys have followed how Ron Unz of Unz.com, which is, you know, it's got some interesting stuff, always has, but it's gotten really interesting in the last 6 months. And the Spectator over in the UK blames me for forcing red pills down Ron Unz's throat. It says ever since Unz published my article at his website, he started coming out with all these horrible anti-Semitic things like 9/11 truth and so on.
And we see, we've been taking a look at Unz, and I am not seeing a legitimate player here. You don't enter the playing field late in the game. It's very simple. You take a look at, I can take a look at you. I take a look at any of us here. It's very simple with me. I grew up in a communist family in Detroit. Simple as that. European immigrants came around the turn of the century. My father was Communist Party, labor organizer. I lived in a house smaller than my bathroom here. I, you know, grew up in a poor neighborhood. I went Marine Corps. I was anti-war movement. I was, you know, deeply involved in the formation of Vietnam Veterans Against the War and Vets for Peace. Have a history of activism, certainly online, that goes back to the early 1990s, but easily seen involvement politically. You know, I worked for Eugene McCarthy. I worked for Teddy. Hell, I even worked for, initially Kefauver and then Adlai Stevenson. We go back that far. Worked for John Kennedy. Worked for... And it was a tough pill.
Wait. Who worked for John Kennedy?
I did.
Like campaigning for him when you were young.
Yes, I worked for Adlai Stevenson before that.
Huh. Were you like going door to door for him, or?
Yes.
Really? Wow.
For Stevenson, well, I started with the Democratic Party, and I started with the Democratic Party in 1956.
Huh. Now, how old were you then?
I was 8 years old.
Okay. Yeah. So you go way back. Ron Unz publishes all this stuff that he's, you know, basically saying he's discovered it. But I don't think he just discovered this stuff. I think that he's known it for a while, but he's been busy and he hasn't really had the time to sit down.
But why do we care about Ron Unz?
Okay. Just because I'm mentioning that he wrote a pretty decent piece about discovery, you know, going back and saying, yeah, Jacob Schiff, this big Jewish bank, it turns out that rumor is true. It's not an.
But he picked it up by copying it from a paper written by Ian and I. It came from the two of us.
I don't know where he copied it from, but the larger point is the Jewish element in communism, and that's where I was trying to steer you.
I'm not using the term plagiarism. Ian, are you still there?
Yes.
How much work did you and I do on Trotsky and Jacob Schiff before Ron? Just only a few weeks before Ron Unz published it, he pulled it from Veterans Today, and then I published a paper on Jacob Schiff. Okay, I published that in Neo, New Eastern Outlook, funded by the Russian Academy of Science, about 6 weeks before Unz published his paper. He took it off, my guess. But is he right? Yeah. And should he have read that? And should he have had a revelation about Jacob Schiff? Yes, he should have. Where was the basic work done? The basic work was essentially done by Ian. And Ian and I did the work.
Were you guys citing the same books that he was citing? I mean, he's citing the memoirs of Henry Wickham Steed and who else? This Ackerman's 2016 book, Trotsky in New York, and things like that. I don't remember that you guys. I think he's coming at it, you know, perhaps stimulated to do it by reading your stuff, but I don't think it's total plagiarism by any means.
There's no shortage of books that cover this.
What he claims to be citing or not. The dots were put together by us, by Schiff, but the issue, of course, Schiff is essentially not just the founder of Zionism, but Schiff created the home that brought the Warburgs, or the Paul Valenzuela family. Now, things you're not looking at, let's say, Kevin, some of the same background as Schiff. Jacob Schiff isn't Jacob Schiff. That's not his name. Paul Warburg is not Paul Warburg. That's not his name. These aren't Germans. None of these people came from Germany. None of their families are German families. They are not Ashkenazi German families. They are all Spanish Sephardic families from Bologna and from Venice. That's where they came from. So when you take the history of, let's say, if you're doing Schiff, you have to do Warburg. Warburg, if you check Wikipedia or any of the materials which Ron would have picked up from us in research, that, well, I don't care. He's not anyone to begin with. But if we look at things, we look at the attempt to represent, and it goes much further than you imagine. There's an attempt to represent Warburg as, and this is this buying in on this Nazi Northern European relativism thing. Paul Warburg in 1654, the Warburg family suddenly became the Warburg family because they moved from Venice. Now, Wikipedia and the sources they use will claim they were the Del Banco family and they were forever from Venice. But however, in 1492, they came to Venice from Spain, where they were the Paul Valenzuela, the Sephardic banker.
Spain until 1492.
Yeah.
The Spanish Inquisition was founded.
Let me hand you a couple more families. The Warburgs aren't the Warburgs, okay? But other families that aren't who they are. Let's go to the other big money families at the time. And if you want to take a look at the period here and watch it fought out, we can watch it fought out between the duel between Aaron Burr. This is one of the little odd things of history. You know, it should be in one of those little TV shows. But Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton. To us, Alexander Hamilton, who's the Rothschilds agent inside the U.S., who helped push through the Constitution, which gave us the Supreme Court and Senate, which were how the Rothschilds managed the United States all this time until they could finally.
Hamilton was the founder of the Federalist Society that runs our judiciary today.
Yeah,
and worst of all, he was the one that created a central bank.
He created the central bank that we tried for. Well, it didn't sit until Paul Warburg created the Federal Reserve Act and became the first director of the Federal Reserve.
Well, Hamilton's back when he had a 20-year charter.
But let's take a look at that same period. We have, let's take the British-born elites, the East Coast elites, the 400, the Astors. Who are the Astors? Does anybody know who the Astors are? John Jacob Astor. Remember Astor, don't you? The Astors. The British elites. Who are the Astors? The Astors, are they Jews? Of course. What is the Astor family? They're Sephardics. Where are they from? They're from Italy. What's his name? Astorga. Well, they're from Spain initially.
It's my opinion that the book called The 13th Tribe, written in the 70s by a Jew called Arthur Koestler, which is the origins of the Khazarian theory, is a deliberate piece of misinformation.
Yes.
Written at the behest of the Sephardic Jews in order to shift the blame onto the Ashkenazi Jews. Now, the Ashkenazi Jews weren't behind the takeover of Britain under Cromwell. They weren't behind the transatlantic slave trade.
Nor the opium trade.
No, they weren't behind the Napoleonic War. You know, they weren't behind the loss of the American colonies for Britain. You know, all of this was the work of the Sephardic Jews.
This is in the Laurent Guyonot book that I translated and published this year, From Yahweh to Zion. There are a couple of chapters there about this Jewish diaspora, the crypto Jews coming out of Spain and Portugal.
Well, let me give you another family here to work with. If we look at the architect of the Vietnam War, whoever you think you're looking at, it's going to come down to one name, Henry Cabot Lodge.
Mm-hmm.
And the family, of course, if we go into the family where the Brits handed over the opium trade when they could no longer move opium on, quote, British bottoms, and we handed over the slate, were the Cabots, the Cabot family. Who are the Cabots?
Cabot was a famous navigator who sailed out of the port of Bristol.
Not the same family.
He was actually...
You're talking John Kevin. Yeah. Well, or what... I'm talking the Kubota family.
Right.
Who are... who settled... Who in 1492 left Spain again. The banking family from Bologna who became the Cabots and the Astors. The critical part when you this is, let me run with this for a quick second, Ian, because, and God, I'm being bad, because Ian's frankly more interesting than I am. One of the things that led me down an interesting trail is a favorite book because of two things. You find new information in books and you find disinformation, as was just pointed out with the Kessler book. One of my favorite authors really is Webster Tarpley. I think Tarpley's, an innovative guy, a great researcher, but Tarpley's also one of the most ham-handed disinformation agents on God's earth. An exhaustive piece he wrote back in the, I'm thinking 1991, is the 1,000-plus page unauthorized biography of George W. Bush, where he's blaming these white industrialists, whatever, as supporting Hitler. And the Bush family history, and he begins to expose pieces of it with disinformation. The Bushes have no history as being part of an East Coast elite. The Bush family is from small beginnings in Columbus, Ohio, when they were picked up, in this case, Prescott Bush, who was the father of George Herbert Walker Bush, was collected by Bunny Harriman. Bunny Harriman was the sister of Abel Harriman Sr., later ambassador.
Columbus, Ohio, just the other side of the Ohio River from St. Louis.
Yeah. And he worked initially as a machinist and then engineer. That's Samuel Bush. That's Samuel Bush. He's not a presidential advisor. He's a damned laborer. They lived in a two-bedroom shack. That's where the Bush family comes from. But the point about this is Bush, when he went to Yale, hooked up to Bunny Harriman. And from that point on, the religion of the Bush family became eugenics.
Mm.
The eugenics movement worldwide was funded by the Harrimans. But who were the Harrimans? The Harrimans within the U.S. were the front for the Warburg family and the Warburg banking family.
Well,
now, when
Tarpley... Today about Southern Ohio Garden, that will explain exactly, add a little depth to this, is that during the 19th century, you had all these dirt poor Germans
who
emigrated to North America. Quite a few of them were Jewish, because the Jews were at the bottom of the social ladder at the time.
My great-great-grandmother may have been one of them, which would make me theoretically Jewish. My mom tells me this. I think she tells me this, though, because, you know, she worries about me being so anti-Zionist that she thinks I might be horrified to find out I had a Jewish ancestor. I could even be Jewish myself. I said, no, Mom, I don't care. It's fine with me, you know.
Everybody's got a Jewish grandmother in their basement somewhere, you know.
Yeah, yeah. You just got to know where the Jewish grandmother is buried. And I'm sure, you know, you guys probably both know about where more Jewish grandmothers are buried than about anybody.
Well, I haven't got any Jews in my family history because you can trace my family back 1,000 years. We always lived in the same place in England. But, yeah, I'll just finish this thing about the German settlers. They sailed up the river as far as St. Louis, where they got off the boat and looked around and went, I don't like it very much here. Because it's full of slaves and brutality and capitalism. So they crossed the river into southern Ohio and set up farms and lived in shacks. They were still very poor.
And they set up the Steubenville. They set up the town of Chillicothe. They set up the town of in this case, which is a... let's say they borrowed from the Greeks. They call it Cincinnati. And Cincinnati, if you drive through Cincinnati, it is full of German row houses still, although they're quickly being torn down. But it was quite an interesting place.
As the 1880s, whole large swaths of that area, people spoke only German. German newspapers published. One was published in Belleville. Another, I can't remember the names of the other towns. But basically, you're talking about an area that was German entirely. And but within it were quite a lot of Jews.
Well, let me go back to the Harriman tale here. The Harriman family was a major banking family. The Harrimans were one of the families that controlled, along with J.P. Morgan, America's railroads. And the largest railroad family in the U.S., you know, was Harriman and
What was the name of the family that had the iron works and they made all the rails? They had a huge investment in the railways because they were the ones that were making the rails.
Yeah, this is old people's brains going.
Well, you know what? I advertised this show as talking about Trump, and maybe we could segue to Trump because he comes from a German background too, and there's also a Jewish in his career.
What you have here is you have a 19th century Slobovian, Schwabian. We call it Slobovia for those of us who live in Germany. It's the area. Whenever you get south of Frankfurt in the middle of Schwabia, you make sure you don't even make sure you got gas before you go through the area. It's like the angry part of Germany.
Yes.
It's Hillbillyville for Germany.
Really, Trump comes from the angry hillbilly part of Germany.
He comes from the angry hillbilly part of Germany, Schwabia, where the minor Drumpf family, God only knows who they are, ran child prostitution San Francisco and in the Yukon for a while, and then fled back to Germany, and then were thrown out of Germany to evade taxes, and brought them back and forth, and then of course came here. And in New York City began as slumlords and human trafficking. That's where the family comes from.
Huge brothel just on the Canadian side of the border that did a roaring trade in the Prohibition era. He was a pimp. He ran a brothel just on the Canadian side of the border. You know, you'd literally walk across the bridge from America when you're there. And he had a role. That was the start of his money in America, running a brothel.
Here's the suspicion that we're getting into as these theories come out here, and whether Ron Owens writes about them or not, is we are finding strong Zionist ties. And these are the hypotheses that we're all looking at right now, all of us collectively. The Ashkenazi are generally accepted by sane people as to never have existed. It's a very simple story. And there's very little of Europe I haven't, I have a background in archaeology and history, as do all of us here on this call. I've driven more miles in Europe than all of you collectively multiplied by 10 and, done more digging crap up. Simply put, in 84 AD to 87 AD, when 100,000, 80,000, 30,000 Jews mysteriously got on non-existent ships and traveled to southern France and moved up through the Roman Empire, crossing up the Rhone Valley, and then crossed over in the area of the Visigoths, traveling into areas where nowadays would be Krakow and Leibniz and whatever, and set up delicatessens and taxi stands and those things in towns that wouldn't be there for 1,100 more years.
Yeah.
Now, when the Ashkenazis moved into this area, now there's no Ashkenazi history at all and for those of you when I talk about Belgenium or Pfalz, the areas where the Ashkenazis claim they settled, and these are the areas of the confluence of the Rhine and Mosul. The area of Roman palaces, as it would be translated to, or the areas north, which is Belgenium. There were no settlements of any kind to the west of Trier. The earliest settlement, or the east rather, was Aachen.
Yeah.
Past there was nothing. I'm sorry. Well, there's no archaeological evidence. No archaeological evidence, and absolutely none. Not one iota of any Jew ever having been there. In that area of Germany, the first synagogue was built in Wittlich in 1823. It had been destroyed, desecrated by the Germans during the period of unpleasantness in the middle of last century, and has been restored. I have visited it several times. In Berncastle, where I live, we had a small synagogue across the street in what later became a woodcarver shop. And where the synagogue is, they began making coffins. Now, that's the only presence there, and that presence dated to around 1750. Now, if you take 87 AD and 1750, that's a long time to be shuffling back and forth waiting for the subway or for a cab to come or sitting on the dock for over 1,000 years. Mm-hmm. The simple truth is there is no genetic support for Ashkenazi Jews to exist. They have no Semitic blood whatsoever when tested as such, according to Johns Hopkins, and VT was the only place that would publish their study. If you want the study on the Jewish genome by Johns Hopkins, there's one way to get it to download. Go to Scribd, Scribd.com, where academic papers are published. Go into my files. My name's Gordon Duff. And the Johns Hopkins paper is by Dr. Enoch Halleck, Israeli, by the way. He submitted it to me, and I put it up for him because nobody else would. That essentially shows there have genetic testing has made it very simple. There are no Ashkenazi. There have never been any Ashkenazi. That if you want to meet a Semitic Jew, go talk to a Palestinian. That's what they did.
There's a lot in Sudan.
Yeah, but it's very simple. You're living somewhere. And remember, Islam didn't exist then. This was the Eastern Roman Empire. It was Christianized first. So the religion, the Jews accepted, we're sorry, but the Jews accepted Christianity and then later accepted Islam.
Right.
Now, Kevin, is it not true that when the Crusaders first hit Jerusalem, there wasn't a single Jew in town? Not one.
You know, I'm actually not sure about that.
I believe I read it in a classic comic, you know, but I assume it to be true. But there were no Jews there, and quite simply put, human nature. If someone comes to you and says, if you don't change your religion, we're going to tax the living shit out of you. It's simple as that. And you're thinking, well, I'm going to lose my house. I'm going to have to sell all my animals to pay the taxes. 3 years from now, I'm going to be starving. Or I can start showing up at whatever church it is and do with that and keep eating. And secretly at home, I can do whatever I want. They generally make that decision.
Well, Gordon, that's not entirely true. I'm not sure about Jerusalem. I think there were some Jews. We can bet on that one. But, you know, I was just traveling in Morocco with my Jewish Chinese friend, John Ravusky, and we were looking at the sad history of the genocidal destruction of the Jewish Moroccan community by the Israeli Mossad. And what we found was that, for instance, we went down to Safi, Morocco, heartland of the Moroccan Jewish community. All that's there now is a cemetery, a huge Jewish cemetery. We talked to the best historian of Safi, and it turns out that from 1400-ish to about 18-something, up into about 1900, it was probably about one-third Jewish on the average, varying between one-quarter and up to 40% Jewish. The Jews in Safi, unlike other Moroccan towns, were not in ghettos. They were mixed in with the Muslim population. Legends say that the town was actually founded by Jews. The Jewish population remained pretty constant up until European colonialism.
But weren't those all...
When the French took over, they brainwashed the Jews into saying, you guys can come join us and live like us rich French guys and not like those poor Muslims that we are exploiting. And so some Jews drifted into the European community of colonialists. But what really put the kibosh on the Moroccan Jewish community was when the Israeli Mossad moved in after the foundation of Israel and essentially bribed the Moroccan state to let them terrorize Moroccan Jews into fleeing their homes. So there was a genocide conducted against this Moroccan Jewish community. They didn't ever have to, they never had to convert to pay taxes. They were doing just fine in Morocco and in most of the lands.
They've been there for over 1,000 years. That Moroccan Jewish community was possibly the oldest Jewish community outside the remnants in Southern Africa.
And 100% and 100% Sephardic.
Well, when the Jews fled the Romans, they settled mostly in Spain and Morocco.
Yes. So and in Persia and Iraq.
Well, yeah, and the terrorization of them by the Mossad happened in Iraq and Egypt as well. In Egypt, everybody knows about it because it became known as the Levant Affair and it failed. But in Iraq, when the Jews came from Europe to Israel in the 1940s, they drove out the Palestinians, which meant that they had some of the richest, best farmland in the world and nobody to work it. Because the Palestinians were the farmers and the European Jews were urban city dwellers who had never done any farming in their lives and they weren't prepared to learn. So they looked around and they said, where are we going to find a replacement agricultural workforce? Preferably a Jewish one. Well, over in Iraq, you had an ancient Jewish community that were Arabs. They were Arabs who just happened to be of the Jewish faith. And they were quite happy in Iraq.
Yeah, so, they were Arab Jews who happened to be Semites like all other Arabs are.
David Ben-Gurion sent Menachem Begin to Iraq with the task of terrorizing the Iraqi Jews so that they would flee to the safety of Israel. So they did things like blowing up Jewish cafes, machine gunning people standing on the corner, street corner in Jewish neighborhoods. You know, this is the sort of thing that we become sickeningly familiar with. But this was, what, 1950, 51? So you ended up with a couple of million Iraqi Jews fleeing to Israel. And that's how David Ben-Gurion got his agricultural labor force. But the thing is, those Iraqi Jews are called blacks by the European Jews. They are treated as fifth-rate people, you know, fifth-rate citizens. The racism of the European Jews towards what they call blacks, which are, you know, any Jews who are not European, is shocking.
And our point being is that Ian and I believe that the European Jews in Israel are fake Jews. They're not Jews at all. They're pretend Jews. They have no Semitic blood at all.
Wait a minute. Judaism is a religion, so anybody can be a Jew if they want to
except that it's not accepted as that.
Ask two rabbis what Judaism is, and they will argue until their dying breath, because what is Judaism? Is it an ethnicity? Is it a race? Is it a religion? You know, is it a nationality? All of these things can be said to be, can be argued. And there's nothing, the old saying is arguing is the Jewish national pastime.
Two rabbis, three opinions. Well, we only have a couple of minutes left, guys, and I did sort of promise we would touch on the articles on Trump and this murder of Khashoggi. So, Gordon, you say that there are actually sources in Saudi security apparatus who have told you that, in fact, the White House, or perhaps more precisely, Cohen, okayed this hit.
Here's what I can more or less, we have conjecture, we have high probability, and we have very, very thin facts. The highest probability, okay? the nature of the hit would have, it would, this would and could not have been done without the participation and approval with Saudi security. That communication would only have come directly from Gina Haspel, director of the CIA. Now, she worked for many years in Saudi Arabia and directly with their counterterrorism forces. They have a long history of killing people, certainly, but not in quite the showy way that this was done. This was done very much CIA style. Why would I know what CIA style is? Because maybe I'm just making it up. But this is what we're fairly certain happened, according to sources. Gina Haspel came to the Saudis and said there was a desire by the United States to make an example of this individual for two reasons. One, and this is where Ian and I disagree, which is fine. And I, you know, I'll tell you, if we had more time, we should argue it out because it's good radio. On December 5th, 2016, in a very reasonable performance in a press conference, Khashoggi, who's no idiot, he's a real journalist. He's a well-spoken guy, long history in Saudi Arabia, asked Trump a couple of strong questions, and Trump went batshit crazy on him. And that's the reason that Khashoggi was thrown out of Saudi Arabia. And then, of course, he went to work for the Washington Post, owned by somebody with 10 times more money than Trump has, who Trump hates. I don't know how much of that made it on the air.
Thank you so much, Senior Editor Gordon Duff and Editor Ian Greenhall.